now.
I don't know who he is behind that mask of his, but I do know when we need him. And we need him now.
I'll call him, sir.
For some reason, the cool bars in Hollywood have to be hard to find and have no sign.
This is the Cocktail Nation.
I have got a fantastic show lined up for you this week. A woman who, by accident, as a teenager, becomes great friends with actor and comedian Paul Lynde. Her incredible story to come. And I made an interesting discovery in a dime store bookshop this week, which led to an interesting journey. Plus, news on the passing of the last remaining cast member of Hogan's Heroes and the best lounge and exotica from across the globe, along with the best parties to attend. Right now, Lee Presson and the Nails.
This is the Cocktail Nation.
Thanks to Ultraswank.net.
Do.
With Mr. Ho's Orchestratica Boulevard of Broken Dreams. Tonight on the program, a woman who's written a marvellous book about Paul Lynde, the great comedian and actor, of course, one of the stars of Bewitched as well. What an amazing man. Paul Lynde, a biography, his life, his love, and his laughter by Kathy Rudolph. She joins me on the line. Kathy, this is an incredible story. Tell us how it happened.
Yes, when I was 17 years old, I had two dreams in my life. One was to be an author, and the other was to meet who I thought was the funniest and most hilarious man I ever saw on television. That was Paul Lynde. And as a Smitten fan, I was doing research on him in the Levittown Public Library, which is located on Long Island in New York, where I grew up. And as I was doing research on Paul Lynde, I found a book of stars, Broadway stars, looked like a resume, said Paul Lynde's business manager's phone number. I went home, I asked my parents if I could call California, that was a long distance call,
yeah.
And my parents said, well, make it person to person, because he's probably not going to answer the phone and it won't cost much. So I dialed the phone and lo and behold, Paul Lynde himself answered the phone. He couldn't believe a fan had found his home telephone number. He just said, oh, my goodness, you know, who is this girl calling me? But we knew so much in chatting, or I knew so much, I should say. He didn't hang up, and he listened. And suddenly I was, you know, blurting out, you know, how's Donnie and Marie Osmond? How's your dog? And he was very fond of his dog. So that kind of connected us. And I asked him if he would meet me in New York, and first he said, no way. And I said, oh, you know, I know you come to New York a lot. And he kept saying, oh, I can't come. I'd have to do this for everyone. Well, lo and behold, I said the magic words, I'll have my father take me.
Yeah.
There was the first moment of silence. And he said, okay, I'll meet you. I'll be in New York in 2 weeks. Come and meet me for 5 minutes only, autograph and a picture. We met. And that five-minute meeting turned out to be over 2 hours and the beginning of a wonderful friendship until he died in 82.
And you kept in contact with him year after year after year for the rest of the time?
Oh, yes. He called me every Christmas. I saw him over a dozen times in the course of his life. He came to my a nearby hometown and did the Paul Lynch show, the tour, not his television show, where he was a one-man show, basically Paul Lynch. He had some singers, Mimi Hines and Roz Clark, I believe, and he sang Kids, and he sang it to me, introduced me to the audience, and he did the great show. He had the whole place laughing, and I've been to Virginia with him. I went dancing with him. I met him in Toronto. We had dinner after the shows. We hung out for a few days there. I've been to his home in California. And the last time I saw him was in Canada, Toronto, about 5 months before he passed away. That was the last time we were together. And as I was saying goodbye to him, he had this fear. Well, he lost his parents and his brother within 3 months of each other. When he was under 30 years old, and that devastated him. So whenever he said goodbye, he'd say, "Don't say goodbye, just say I'll see you soon." And I accidentally said, "Goodbye, Paul." And then he said, "No, no, don't say that." And that ended up being the last time I saw him, unfortunately. But we did speak Christmas Eve right before he did pass away, a few weeks before he passed away. And, you know, I had the best times of my life with this man. He was wonderful, always a gentleman, took me into his very personal life, and he was a very personal, private man. And I am blessed that I had gotten to know him. And the book is about his life story, his struggles. It does include Paul and I's adventures, and they were hilarious adventures. Some of them very unique. And our relationship was very unique. And I go into the details. His relatives were kind enough to provide me with many pictures that are rare or never seen before. And I have my own pictures that were never published before as well.
What's interesting is you talk about when his parents and his brother died, because that really left him out on his own in New York City. And when he was starting to really make it, suddenly his father's not there to foot the bill for him anymore. And it really made him have to work for what he wanted, didn't it?
Yes, he had to sell his blood. He got so desperate, and I don't know how many people know that Paulin was 250 pounds when he was 10 years old, all through high school, and when he went to New York, and he was devastated, no money, you know, very, you know, down and out, living in a very rundown place. And had to, he admitted he stole food out of refrigerators. It was like a commune type of refrigerator. And, yeah, he struggled. He sold his blood. He worked in, some restaurants. He loved being a waiter and later became a gourmet cook, one of Hollywood's finest. But yeah, he struggled very hard. It took him 9 years before he really, really got his, bit of fame.
Yeah. So it was around about 1950. He got a bit of a break in a talent quest, and then eventually he ended up on a skit show as well. Was it New Faces, I think it was called?
New Faces of 1952. That is correct. That was the first break for him. But, you know, as big as it was, he wrote his own monologue, the African monologue, which is known as the African Trip or the Trip of the Month Club.
Yeah.
And it was a very kind of a macro-based sense of humor, very dark humor. And it would take a while. It would actually take decades for people to catch on. But they did like him. The critics liked him. But then nothing came his way. I mean, a couple of shows here and there, but not until Bye Bye Birdie, which was, I believe, 9 years later, 1960 to 52, a long, long stretch before he had another shot.
Didn't think too much of the Bye Bye Birdie movie, though, did he, which he was cast in?
No, he didn't like it because he felt... he felt they had changed his scenes. He thought he had better lines and better scenes and more scenes in the actual play. And when they changed it over to the film, he joked a few times saying it should have been called, Hello, Anne Margaret, because Anne Margaret was this new, you know, young, sexy 21-year-old playing the part of his daughter. And he had to dye his hair gray, because he was only 33 years old, and he had to look older for the part. And he thought the movie kind of went around her a little too much. So he was brilliant, and he had good critics. But he just, he didn't like it. No, not particularly. He was good in it, though. I think most people would agree.
He seemed to pick up a lot of character roles and a lot of variety TV shows and movies and things like that, but it was really Bewitched that made it for him, starting off as a driving instructor on the show.
Yes, he played Harold, and Bill Asher was good friends with him. They had getting a good friendship going from another movie they did together, and he cast him for just one little show called, I think it's called Driving is the Only Way to Fly, if I recall. Mm. And Paul played a neurotic, driving instructor and yelling selfish to people who wouldn't move out of the way. And his co-star, who was the star of the show, Elizabeth Montgomery, told Bill, he is so hilarious and so fun. We got to make him a regular character. So they made him Uncle Arthur, which was actually named after Elizabeth Montgomery's paternal uncle. I think his name was Cushing, if I recall. And Paul became a hit with that character. It was probably one of his famous up there with Bye Bye Birdie and the voice of Charlotte's Web.
That was the
rat.
The first time I saw him was on Bewitched, and I just thought he was absolutely marvellous. I didn't know about the Hollywood Squares. Hollywood Squares was, that was massive for him. He made a lot of money out of that, but he often felt a little bit pigeonholed, didn't he?
Yes, the Hollywood Squares was actually, I think most people, including myself, really got to know his wild, wild humour. It was fine for a while. It did give him fame when he did he did a lot of summer stock plays all over, and people, he always said, it's Hollywood Squares, that's what fills the seats. Every show was sold out. He went to school for acting, Northwestern. He went with Charlton Heston and Patricia Neal, and, they all had their eyes on the big fame, and many of them made it to Oscars, and Paul wanted that. He really wanted that. But, Hollywood Squares, after 15 years or even before that, he was, I don't want to be known for a game show.
Yeah.
Even though it was making him famous.
Yeah. Yeah, do you think this this was part of his drinking issues? I know he struggled with that, but I think that probably began a little bit earlier when he was hanging out with Dick Van Dyke and others in those early days. Would you say that the Hollywood Squares probably contributed a little bit to that problem?
It may have made him more frustrated. It could have. He really was very big on drinking in his very early, college years. Well, from what I know is in New York City is really what I know. He used to say he stayed out to after hours bars till the morning. He loved it. He loved New York. He loved partying. Absolutely. Yeah, I think it kind of snuck up on him and kind of took its grip on him. And that made him not so nice to certain people, not everybody, but, and that started to give him a reputation that he wasn't too nice when he drank, but he could be funny as hell too.
That's what I wanted to ask you too, because obviously you knew him very well. From the research that I've done, a lot of people, there seem to be mixed reactions. A lot of people really loved him as a friend, but other people said when he got drunk, he got really mean and was really difficult to be around. Did you ever see any of that?
I have never. He only got more mellow with me and more, more happy, more, I've seen him with many, many, many drinks in him. Mm. And he's always been a lot of fun with me. But I think it's the people he's around and what was going on in his life at the time. And, it could be a little envious if somebody was doing better than him, because he had that, he had a big ego, but he also had low self-esteem at the same time, which is a seesaw. And when you drink and you're feeling really low, you might spit out some terrible things at people, and he did. And when I did my research with his colleagues and his peers, many of them said it, and I don't hide it in the book. I was very fair. I think I was fair and honest. And Paul had once told a friend of his, if anybody writes a book, they should make it the truth. I went with what I knew of him and what other people told me. I warts and all, as they say, as the saying goes, it is in there. But I also think it's a nice tribute to the man he was and the gifts he left us. My God, what a legacy. These hilarious jokes, these zingers, and his characters, and just anything he was in. You just laughed. You come home from a hard day's work or you had a personal problem. And like my dad always said, there was Paul then, just to make you forget your troubles for that half hour on Hollywood Squares.
Yeah, that's amazing. Eventually, he had, I know he had dreams of having his own show, which he eventually got his own show, which only ran for like a season, I think, wasn't it?
It ran for a whole year.
Yeah.
And he said at the end, it was, he was rewriting the scripts. It became, it tortured him. He was so, but he was like this with every show, but if he was a perfectionist. If it didn't go right, he would rewrite. If he didn't think something was funny, and he would say this if he was on Dean Martin or whatever shows, he would let them know that line's not funny. Sometimes they changed it. Sometimes he had to say it anyway. But with his own show, he said, you know, if it fails, it's going to be me that fails. And he didn't want that. Mm-hmm. But after a year, when it was going down the drain, he did tell some reporters, you know, well, if it doesn't make it, it's okay, too. I don't know if he really felt like that or he was just, you know, saying that because that was a big deal. He wanted his own show for so long. And I think it's funny. Matter of fact, I hope one day, you know, they're bringing back all the nostalgia, the Bewitched, the I Dream a Genie. I'd love to see the Paul Lynde show back on. It's better than a lot of things are on. Out there right now.
That would be fantastic to see. To talk about, if I may, some of the controversy around him, particularly in the later years. What's the story with Jim Davidson?
Oh, a sad situation. Him and Jim went down to for a weekend in San Francisco. They stayed at a hotel, and they went out partying for the night. And when they came back in, from what I read in the papers, because Paul talked about this with me, but he just touched on it. The paper said that Paul came in first, and about 15 minutes later, Jim followed. And then there was a ruckus or something going on, and then some people saw Jim hanging off of the hotel balcony. And long story short, Paul later said, you know, he wasn't really paying much attention to him, and the guy slipped and fell. Paul tried to help him, and the poor guy fell to his death, and that devastated Paul. And that happened, oh gosh, I want to say 64, if I remember correctly. And I met him in 76, and we were at his house in 77, I think, and then went to a beautiful benefit for children, and somebody, you know, something clicked in his head, and he asked me, did you ever hear what happened with Jim Davidson? I mean, I hadn't, and I looked at him, I said, I don't know who he is, and he was still, it bothered him, it still was in his head, and he asked me if I knew about that. That's how much it bothered him.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like he was a very, very, very private man. I understand that he was very, very particular about his house.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Concerned about people when they come over parties and stuff like that. But generally a very private man, and this is in the days too, before people were making a big stand about their sexuality. I mean, it was considered more of a private thing back then and not something that people necessarily made a big deal about. But he was a gay man, to my understanding. But it wasn't something he really was that showy about, it seemed. It seemed like that was a very, very private thing.
It was a private thing, and in the era, the 70s, I don't know of any, and this is to my knowledge, any comedian who or actor or anybody in the spotlight of the media would admit it, not to my knowledge. And Paul, with his jokes on Squares, he didn't hide it. Now, he didn't write all the jokes, and the producers and the whole Hollywood Squares, you know, they knew he was gay. In Hollywood, you knew people were gay, but it would never go to the public. Reporters respected it. It was just a whole different era then. But Paul was, you know, As the 70s came, I thought he was starting to, you know, display it a little bit. You know, he was starting to get very brave about it. But, you know, before that, if he came out, your career is destroyed. I believe that's what would have happened if he did.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand he used to talk about a lost love, though, a gal that he knew in high school of unrequited love. Did he ever talk about that story? Did you look into that?
Oh, I spoke to his high school girlfriend at the time, Marilyn. Mm-hmm. She was lovely. Yeah, they went out, you know, from, I guess, eighth grade till high school. And, you know, I don't think she was as serious as him. And he just, I guess, thought, like any man or a young man, you're going to go off, get college, and get married, and That never happened for him. She married somebody else, sent him an invitation. He was devastated, and he said he went home and sobbed. He told the reporter he went home and sobbed uncontrollably when he heard that. And they remained friends. But, you know, he eventually, you know, figured out he was gay, or I don't know what part of his life that he knew it, you know.
Yeah.
He had a lot of tragedies.
Yeah. Now,
I don't know what affected him.
Towards the end, eventually he decided to clean up his act and give up drinking, which would have been I would imagine a big deal.
Yeah, from his friends and people I spoke to, he never elaborated as to why, but he did, and I don't know what happened to scare him. I'm guessing something did, or he just had an incident. I don't know, but when I went out with him, you know, we went back to his hotel with a group of us and the cast, and we were hanging out, and everybody, we were having cocktails, and Paul was drinking, I believe it was a Tab at that time. Mm. Remember that diet soda? So he stopped, you know, and he was very serious, and he was very quiet and shy in person. If he had drinks, he'd be, you know, he could be funny straight, too, I mean, without drinks. But, he'd get more hilarious, I thought, when he drank a drink. So I also saw him in a very somber states as well. So, he seemed to have cut out all the booze when I saw him last.
Yeah, and it was,
which is nice.
Was that close to 1982 when he died? Or was it a fair bit?
Yeah, I saw him in August. Actually, it was August 31st through September 2nd or 3rd in Canada. He was doing a tour, I believe, with Beverly Sanders. I think it was one of the Neil Simon suites. And might have been Plaza Suite even. But I'm not sure exactly. That's when I saw him. And we went out to dinner. We went for a Chinese restaurant. And when we got back to the hotel, you know, we had liquor there, me and my friend Debbie, who came with me. And he wasn't drinking. In fact, he gave me a dirty look when I went up to get my second drink. He gave me a look like, you know, what are you doing? And I said, oh, this is different. I was also older then. I was, you know, 22. When he met me, I was 17. So that was kind of a... It was actually sweet when I think about it now.
Yeah. He died at the age of 55. It was a massive heart attack, I believe, wasn't it?
Yes.
Very sad, considering he just, you know, started to clean up his health for that to happen. I imagine there must have been a big outpouring of grief at the time in 1982. He was still a big name back then.
Oh, my goodness. It was, for me personally, I mean, the world lost a great comedian. They lost a great showman. It was very hard for me. I was sitting in my office. It was like 8:30 in the morning in New York, and a girlfriend, Robin, called me and said, you know, just heard in the radio, Paul and his dad. Mm. Well, I didn't believe her, so I called Paul immediately.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, half afraid I'd wake him up, because it was only 6:30 in the morning there, or 3 hours different. And I was half afraid he wouldn't answer. And his answering service rather, answered. And they didn't know anything. And then 20 minutes later, you know, I'm sitting at my desk, my mother called. Mm. And as soon as I heard her voice, I knew.
Mm.
Yeah, it was very, you know what, it was hard. It was very hard. It was very hard not having him in my life anymore. You know,
imagine, yeah.
Looking forward to mails and letters and the phone calls and going out with this great celebrity who treated me so equally, so wonderful, so just so caring. That was a tough time.
What a wonderful opportunity to, and certainly something that doesn't happen to very many people in the world, that they get to know a celebrity that well as just as a regular Joe. It's rare. It's a blessing, and
it is a blessing,
and kind of lucky when you think about it. If you hadn't picked up,
you know what? You know what? It could be lucky. I like to say the word grace, because I believe, you know, that God aligned the stars just right so Paul and I could meet, for many reasons. One is I think we needed each other. I was, you know, teenage years are very, very hard, and here this celebrity is paying attention to me. I was a skinny kid, and, you know, I had my dream come true. But I think it's more ironic that I feel like it came full circle. Here it is. I've always wanted to write a book, and guess what? The book's about Paul, and I just...
Well,
that blows my mind.
Well, it's amazing. Both of your dreams came through.
Yes, they did. And, you know, I met Paul and I wrote the book about him. I just, didn't ever knew what, I always knew how to write a book. I wasn't sure years ago what it would be about. But as I got older, I always said, I'm going to write this book. So I finally did.
Well, Kathy, congratulations. Paul Lynde, biography, his life, his love, his laughter. Kathy Rudolph, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, Cooper, and I appreciate you having me on. And I hope everybody enjoys the book because I think it's really a nice tribute to a great man who gave so much.
Indeed, available through Bear Manor Media. Good to talk to you, Kathy.
And you too. Thank you so much.
She said, I know what it's like to be dead. I know what it is to be sad. And she's making me feel like I've never been born. I said, who put all those things in your head? Things that make me feel that I'm mad. And you're making me feel like I've never been born. She said, you don't understand what I said. I said, no, 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 you're wrong, but I was a boy. Everything was right. Everything was right, I said. Even though you know what you know, I know that I'm ready to leave. 'Cause you're making me feel like I've never been born. She said, you don't understand what I said. I said, no, 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 you're wrong, when I was a boy. Everything was right. Everything was right, I said. Even though you know what you know, I know that I'm ready to leave. And you're making me feel like I've never been born.
Cocktail Nation, Coop Cooper, Aaron Dial there with Lou Nudin. It's all thanks to ultraswank.net. Got some great stories on our website, www.cocktailnation.net. Check out the news of the world stories. We try and bring you some regular news stories throughout the week. Here's a couple that you might like to check out. Story of a serial spy from the 1940s, 50s and 60s. An incredible news story, real story too. And does the name Diana Rigg ring any bells for you? She's the girl that played Emma Peel in the Avengers back in the 1960s. Great story about her life at 75, because she's had quite a successful career even after Avengers, which of course would be very, very hard to beat. You might remember her in Game of Thrones more recently. And a great little story about Forbidden Island Alameda, a great little tiki bar that you might like to read about in our News of the World section. Lots of other stories too there as well that you might like to check out online. Cocktailnation.net is Oscar Castroneves and Bossa Nova Cha Cha.
Bossa Nova Cha Cha. Bossa Nova Cha Cha. Bossa Nova Cha Cha. Bossa Nova Cha Cha.
The Cocktail Nation.
Nation with Nathan Haynes and Cocktails. All thanks to ultraswank.net as we broadcast across the globe from the Sydney penthouse. And I must say a big hello to a new listener of the show. This is Kenny Sartre, who lives in Israel. And he says, I'm your biggest fan in Israel. You probably are. You may be my only fan, Kenny. He's originally from Miami. And he says, keep up the great work. Well, thank you, Kenny. Certainly, if there's any lounge going on in Israel, tell me about it. We'll get it on the radio show for you ASAP.
What's reading in the penthouse library?
Now, the book I want to talk about tonight is called Word Slingers. And it's an interesting story how this all came about. I was in one of those dime store bookstores the other day, and I came across all these books, a whole stack of Western pulps redone. Now, I remember seeing a huge collection of Western pulps when I was living in a little town in New South Wales, Western New South Wales, called Tamworth, country music capital of Australia, as it turns out. And I was going through an antique store, and there was just boxes and boxes of these Westerns, so many. And I did think to myself at the time, mostly when I was reading pulp detective books, I thought to myself, if only these were pulp detective books, I could pick up some more of these. I'd buy the whole collection there. But I didn't buy these Westerns because I've never really been into the Western at all, ever. But there were some great books on there. Ranger Lee series here at this dime store bookstore. George Bridges with Tumbleweed Trail. Colt McDonald, Bullets for Buckaroos. Beautiful artwork. Absolutely fantastic. And they were re-released, Western Pulps, by HarperCollins at just $1.47. Like I said, I've never really been into the Westerns. But the interesting thing about Westerns, as far as both pulps is concerned, and the TV shows and the movies in the 1950s and 1960s, we, of course, these days just love things like Mad Men and whatnot. Period pieces. Well, back in the 1950s and 1960s, that was their period piece. Remember, Dean Martin used to love kicking back and watching a Western. So the book that I found this week that I've been flipping through is called Word Slingers. By a fellow called Will Murray. Now, it's not really a history of the Western Pulp magazine, but it does contain enough information for someone to assemble a history. It's a very, very interesting book. Now, Mr. Murray spent years searching the pages of Writer's Digest and similar magazine for letters and articles that tell the story. So, well worth checking out. Some great artwork in there as well. It is called Word Slingers. I thought, how funny. When I saw all these reproduction Western Pulps, took me back about 15 years when I saw this whole box of Western Pulse and wondered if I should buy them. Maybe I should have. Percussion and guitars, jazz, pizzicato now on the Cocktail Nation.
Email. email Cooper today, thecocktailnation@gmail.com.
With George Shearing, Days of Wine and Roses, and some news out of our News of the World tab that you might like to check out, cocktailnation.net. Cynthia Lynn, best known for her role in Hogan's Heroes, has died at the age of 76. She was Helga, the blonde secretary, the rather gorgeous blonde secretary of Colonel Klink. She was in 22 episodes of Hogan's Heroes, the CBS sitcom, which of course ran for six seasons, ran from 65 through to 71. Played Helga during the first season and had two uncredited appearances in later seasons. But it wasn't just Hogan's Heroes that she was in. She also had roles in Mission Impossible, The Odd Couple, The $6 Million Man. And in addition to her work in Marlon Brando's 1965 film Bedtime Story, her other claim to fame was that her daughter, Lisa, publicly claimed that Brando was her father. This was shortly after Brando's death in 2004. Cynthia Lynn, she was among the last surviving of the series' regular cast members from Hogan's Heroes. Time for a look at the world of swank now, thanks to TikiDelights.com. TikiCon 2014 is on again, July 11, the Pacific Northwest Polynesian Pop Extravaganza at the Red Lion Hotel in Vancouver. The final Aloha in June, June 11 through to the 15th, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, of the Hukilau. Beat Tiki, August 14 in San Diego. May 17, Alika Lyman Group at Tiki Caliente. Martini Kings got a whole stack of gigs right through to August on my website, cocktailnation.net. You'll find all those details. DJ Baz is playing some new jazz and Latin beats Wednesdays, 8 p.m. through midnight at 369 North Palm Canyon Drive, in downtown Palm Springs. Otto's Grotto, the regular gigs back on a Thursday now at Forbidden Island. On Sunday, March 23rd, Swing and Safari, Julie Wilson and the Andy Firth Big Band playing at Soldiers Point, British Columbia, soldierspointbc.com.au. Coming up in April and in May, both Saturday, April 5 and May 10th, 254 North Palm Canyon Drive, Palm Springs, Tikiaki 50. And in April, Mojave Oasis is back again. MojaveOasis.com, the website to go to April 11, 12, and 13. These gigs and many more online, cocktailnation.net. Here's Al Kiola and Underwater Chase on the Cocktail Nation.
This is the Cocktail Nation.
Nation, Langley to Coop Cooper. Next week, we've got some more classic comedy lined up. Another trip back to the 1960s and the 1950s, back into a smoky nightclub with a comedian at the helm, cracking the gags while the martinis are tied on. Gotta leave you now with Martin, Denny, and Cool. Stay here.